The what is generally referred to as a 404B instruction, the one that I gave after Officer Stevens testified, the law says it should be given also at this point. Do you remember what I'm talking about, Mr. Deegan?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want it given again?
You know, I would appreciate that, given the fact of the prejudicial nature of what was said, because what can be implied from that was highly prejudicial.
Okay. Sometimes people don't like those issues being brought up in front of a jury again, and that's why I just wanted to check.
No, I think it should be enforced again.
I am going to ask, of course, in front of the jury, whether you have any more evidence, Mr. Deegan, so that the jury can hear you say.
Now, I don't think I published the complaint in front of them.
Well, it'll be available for them, and I'll tell them that.
Okay.
All the exhibits will be available for them if they want to see it. And I don't know, did we tell them what it was?
No, because Phil wasn't here, okay. And then we decided while they were out.
Is it okay if I just tell them that it is a copy of the complaint that you filed with the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals?
Yeah, that's fine. That's
okay.
Fine. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure they knew because I didn't get a chance to say, can I publish this to the jury?
Right. And then if they want to see it, they'll be able to see it when they deliberate. Is that acceptable?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. So I'll ask the jury if I'll say, once the jury comes back in, I'll say, Mr. Deegan, do you have any other evidence? And then you answer however you wish to answer. And then I'll ask the state, of course, if they have any rebuttal. And then if appropriate at that time, then we'll just go ahead and instruct. Okay, let's have the jury. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, Defendant's Exhibit 5 was admitted, and I think there was some brief testimony, but we're not sure, so we just want to let you know that is a copy of the complaint or petition that Mr. Deegan filed with the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals. And that's been admitted, and that, along with all the other exhibits that have been admitted, will be available for you to review during your deliberations if you would like to see that or any of the other exhibits. So. All right, Mr. Deegan, do you have any other evidence?
No.
Mr. Rogers, any rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, at this point in the trial, the judge is required to inform you as to the law applicable to this case to govern you in your deliberations. And just to let you know, a copy of these instructions will also be available for you to review during your deliberation if you want them. All you have to do is let us know that you'd like to have a copy, and you'll have a copy, just like the exhibits will be available. In any jury trial, there are, in effect, two judges. I'm one of the judges, the other is you, the jury. It is my duty to preside over the trial and determine what testimony and evidence is relevant and admissible under the law for your consideration. It is also my duty at this stage of the trial to instruct you on the law applicable to this case. You, as jurors, are judges of the facts. That is, you are to determine what actually happened in this case. But in reaching your decision as to the facts, It is your sworn duty to follow the law that I am now in the process of defining for you. You must not change the law or apply your own idea of what you think the law should be. Both the court and the jury are bound by the law as stated in this charge. You are not to single out one instruction alone as stating the law, but must consider the instructions as a whole. Neither are you to be concerned with the wisdom of any rule of law stated by me. Regardless of any opinion you may have as to what the law is or ought to be, it would be a violation of your sworn duty to base a verdict upon any view of the law other than that given in the instructions of the court, just as it would be a violation of your sworn duty as judges of the facts to base a verdict upon anything other than the evidence in this case. Nothing said or done by the lawyers who have tried this case is to be considered by you as evidence of any fact. And again, since Mr. Deegan is representing himself, whenever I say in these instructions lawyers or counsel, I'm referring, of course, to Mr. Deegan in his role as representing himself in this case. The function of the lawyers is to point out those things that are most significant or most helpful to their side of the case, and in doing so, to call your attention to certain facts or inferences that might otherwise escape your notice. In the final analysis, however, it is your own recollection and interpretation of the evidence that controls in this case. What the lawyers say is not binding upon you. Your verdict shall be based upon the evidence as you heard it from the witness stand and as you recollect it, not as the lawyers may recollect it. Likewise, nothing I have said or done at any time during the trials to be considered by you as evidence of any fact or as indicating any opinion concerning any fact or the credibility of any witness or the weight to be given to any evidence. You should disregard entirely questions and exhibits to which an objection was sustained, or answers and exhibits ordered stricken out of the evidence. It is not the province of the jury to determine the admissibility of any exhibit or other testimony. Do not draw any conclusions or speculations as to why or why not certain testimony or other evidence was either excluded or admitted. Although you may consider only the evidence in this case, you are permitted to draw such reasonable inferences from the testimony and exhibits as you feel are justified in the light of common experience. In other words, you may make deductions and reach conclusions which reason and common sense lead you to draw from the facts which have been established by the testimony and evidence in this case. You may also consider either direct or circumstantial evidence. Direct evidence is the testimony of one who asserts actual knowledge of the fact to be proven, such as an eyewitness. Circumstantial evidence is proof of other facts and circumstances which from the usual connection of things and from the relation of cause and effect leads to the reasonable conclusion that the facts thought to be proved exist. The law makes no distinction between the weight to be given to either direct or circumstantial evidence. It requires only that before a defendant can be convicted, you must carefully weigh all the evidence and be convinced of the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, I have said that you must consider all the evidence. This does not mean, however, that you must accept all the evidence as true and accurate. You are the sole judges of the credibility or believability of each witness and the weight to be given to his or her testimony. As used in this charge, credibility of a witness means the truthfulness or lack of truthfulness of a witness. The weight of the evidence means the extent to which you are or are not convinced by the evidence. The number of witnesses testifying on one side or the other on any issue is not alone the test of the credibility of any witness or the weight of the evidence. If warranted by the evidence, you may believe one witness against the number of witnesses testifying differently. The tests are how truthful is the witness and how convincing is his or her evidence in the light of all the evidence and circumstances shown. In determining the credit and weight you will give to the testimony of any witness who has testified before you, you may consider, if you found from the evidence, his or her, you may consider if found by you from the evidence, his or her good memory or lack of memory, his or her interest or lack of interest in the outcome of the trial, his or her demeanor or manner of testifying, his or her opportunity and means or lack of opportunity and means of having knowledge of the matters concerning which he or she testified, the reasonableness or unreasonableness of his or her testimony, his or her apparent fairness or lack of fairness. And from these and all other conditions and circumstances appearing from the evidence, you may give to the testimony of the witness such credit and weight as you believe it is entitled to receive. A witness may be discredited or impeached by contradictory evidence, by showing that he or she testified falsely concerning a material matter, or by evidence that at some other time the witness has said or done something or has failed to say or do something which is inconsistent with the witness's present testimony. If you believe that any witness has been so impeached, then it is your exclusive province to give the testimony of that witness such credit and weight, if any, as you may think it deserves. You may believe such parts of their testimony as you believe to be true, and reject such parts as you believe to be false. Or you may refuse to believe any part of such testimony, for it is a matter for you to determine, from all the testimony taken and all the circumstances surrounding this case, what witnesses have testified truthfully, and what ones, if any, have testified falsely. The defendant, Thomas Deegan, has no duty to take the witness stand as a witness on his own behalf. And if he does not do so, this is not evidence, and you should draw no inference therefrom as to his guilt or innocence. You should entirely disregard and not discuss it. The case that you have been sworn to try is a criminal case. The state has the entire burden of proof in criminal cases to prove the guilt of the defendant as charged in the indictment beyond a reasonable doubt. This burden never shifts to a defendant, for the law never imposes upon a defendant in a criminal case the burden or duty of calling any witness or producing any evidence. Criminal cases are brought to court by way of what we call an indictment. The indictment or formal charge against the defendant is not evidence and is not to be considered by you as having any weight whatsoever as evidence against the defendant. No juror should permit himself or herself to be influenced against the defendant because of or on account of the indictment in this case. The law presumes a defendant to be innocent of the crime charged in the indictment. Thus, a defendant, although accused, begins the trial with a clean slate, with no evidence against him. And the law permits nothing but legal evidence presented before the jury to be considered in support of any charge against the accused. So, the presumption of innocence alone is sufficient to acquit a defendant unless the jurors are satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt of the defendant's guilt after careful and impartial consideration of all the evidence in this case. It is not required that the state prove guilt beyond all possible doubt. The test is one of reasonable doubt. A reasonable doubt is a doubt based upon reason and common sense, the kind of doubt that would make a reasonable person hesitate to act. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt, therefore, must be proof of such a convincing character that a reasonable person would not hesitate to rely or act upon it. The jury will remember that a defendant is never to be convicted on mere suspicion or conjecture. If the jury views the evidence as reasonably permitting either of two conclusions, one of innocence, the other of guilt, the jury should, of course, adopt the conclusion of innocence. It is not sufficient to prove that the defendant was probably guilty, but such guilt must be established by strong and sufficient evidence to remove from the minds of the jury every reasonable doubt to the contrary. If, after considering all the evidence in this case, there remains in the minds of the jury a reasonable doubt as to the guilt of the accused is entitled to the benefit of that doubt, and you must acquit him. Before the defendant can be convicted, the state must overcome the presumption that he is innocent and prove to your satisfaction, beyond a reasonable doubt, that he is guilty as charged in the indictment. The offense charged in the indictment in this case is making terroristic threats. You may return one of two verdicts under the indictment. They are guilty of making terroristic threats and not guilty. Making terroristic threats is knowingly and willfully threatening to commit a terroristic act with or without the intent to commit the act. A terroristic act is an act which is likely to result in serious bodily injury or damage to property or the environment and intended to intimidate or coerce the civilian population, influence the policy of a branch or level of government by intimidation or coercion, affect the conduct of a branch or level of government by intimidation or coercion, or retaliate against a branch of level of government for a policy or conduct of the government. Before the defendant, Thomas Deegan, can be convicted of making terroristic threats, the state of West Virginia must prove to the satisfaction of the jury beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant, Thomas Deegan, in Wood County, West Virginia, on or about a certain date in September 2015, did unlawfully, intentionally, knowingly, and willfully threaten to commit a terroristic act with or without the intent to commit said terroristic act. if after impartially considering, weighing, comparing all the evidence, the jury and each member of the jury is convinced beyond a reasonable doubt of the proof of the charge as to each of these elements of making terroristic threats, you may find Thomas Deegan guilty of making terroristic threats as charged in the indictment. If the jury and each member of the jury has a reasonable doubt of the truth of the charge as to any one or more of these elements of making terroristic threats, you shall find the defendant, Thomas Deegan, not guilty. The term threat or threatens is a communicated intent to inflict physical or other harm on any person or on property, a declaration of an intention to injure another or his property by some unlawful means, an avowed present determination or intent to injure presently or in the future. You have heard evidence concerning alleged conduct or other acts of the defendant which are not charged in this indictment. You are instructed that such evidence is not admitted as proof of the defendant's guilt on the present charge. This evidence is admitted for a limited purpose only, and it may be considered by you only in deciding whether a given issue or element relevant to the present charge has been proven. In this instance, the evidence of the defendant being on home confinement may be considered only for the purpose of determining whether the defendant had the opportunity to commit the crime or be on the conference call, and whether the defendant was in Wood County on the date of the alleged crime. You may not use this. Such evidence is not relevant to any other matters, such as the character of the defendant, whether the defendant is a bad person, or whether the defendant had the propensity or the disposition to commit the crime charged. This evidence may not be considered in that regard, since the defendant's character is not an issue. In addition, it is not proper for the state to prove a criminal case by evidence that a defendant may have committed other criminal acts or may be a bad person. Accordingly, this evidence may be considered by you only for the limited purpose for which it has been admitted. You will note that it is alleged that the offense was committed on or about a certain date. The proof need not establish with certainty the exact date of the alleged offense. It is sufficient if the evidence in the case establishes beyond a reasonable doubt that the offense was committed on a date reasonably near the date alleged. I caution you, members of the jury, that you are here to determine the guilt or innocence of the accused from the evidence in this case. The defendant is not on trial for any act or conduct or offense not alleged in the indictment. You are in no way concerned with the civil liability, if any, of the defendant to any person for any of the acts and conduct described to the defendant in the evidence. Neither are you called upon to return a verdict as to the guilt or innocence of any other person or persons not on trial as a defendant in this case. Also, the punishment provided by law for the offense charged in the indictment is a matter exclusively within the province of the court and should never be considered by the jury in any way in arriving at an impartial verdict as to the guilt or innocence of the accused. Any verdict must represent the considered judgment of each juror. In order to return a verdict, it is necessary that each juror agree thereto. In other words, your verdict must be unanimous. It is your duty as jurors to consult with one another and to deliberate in an effort to reach agreement, if you can do so, without violence to individual judgment. Each of you must decide the case for yourself, but only after an impartial consideration of the evidence in the case with your fellow jurors. In the course of your deliberations, do not hesitate to re-examine your own views and change your opinion if convinced it is erroneous. But do not surrender your honest conviction as to the weight or effect of the evidence solely because of the opinion of your fellow jurors or for the mere purpose of returning a verdict. You must not allow your verdict to be influenced by sympathy, passion, prejudice, or public sentiment for or against the defendant or the state. Remember, at all times you are not partisans. You are judges, judges of the facts. Your sole interest is to seek the truth from the evidence in this case. Roger.
Thomas Deegan is guilty of making terroristic threats because he threatened, and in fact he plotted, to take over the government of the state of West Virginia. On September the 14th, 2015, Thomas Deegan led a conference call, as we heard, with people from all over the United States, California, Florida, Texas, all over. And he called for them to take up arms and come to the state of West Virginia, our capital, Charleston, and throw our officials out by force, if necessary, to replace them with their own. We heard the conference call. We heard a number of people speaking, but it was Thomas Deegan that made these threats. It was Thomas Deegan that plotted against our state and the Capitol and the officials within to overthrow our government. These are terroristic acts. We heard the conference call, the 2.5 approximately hours long, and every statement that he made. And I'll get back to the conference call, but what did we hear after we heard the conference call? Well, in the middle of the conference call, we heard that this takeover was set to take place on September the 24th, 10 days after this phone call, 10 days, September the 24th, 2015. Yesterday, we also saw a video that was taken after that conference call. We saw Thomas Deegan, we heard his voice, and we heard him being asked about this takeover. In fact, they referred to it as the takeover of West Virginia. What was Thomas's reply? He said, on paper it's already done, but physically it's not going to happen with the group from the conference call that we heard. Why? Because there were federal agents that were listening. The threat was made. We heard it on the conference call. It was confirmed again in that video that we heard. In that video that we saw, rather. And then today, what did we hear? From the defendant's own evidence, we heard a conference call that had taken place the week after. Those threats, he still wanted to go through with that plan, but it wasn't going to happen because there were too many federal agents on the phone. He still wanted to go through. He had too many federal agents on him, but if somebody else wanted to go through with it, they'd help him out. We also have this filing that was entered into evidence today that you can look at. And I ask if you need to read the filing. It's the same type of discussion that you heard in that conference call, that you saw on that video, that he filed with the Supreme Court. He wants all these officials out of their offices. He wants to liquidate the treasury of all its assets. We confirmed, even through the defendant, that was him on that conference call. He offered up that second conference call today and allowed you to hear the portion that he was talking on that conference call. But what were the statements that were made that were these threats of terrorist acts? We all heard them, but I want to go over a few of them with you. And you'll be able to take the disc back, the conference call, and if you need to, I ask that you do listen to it.
Okay, Tom, we're ready for you.
Alright, so what I'm going to just tell you is what's happening at an international level. And that is, the entire world is under a conquest right now. And so there are no rules, there are no laws.
We heard there are no rules, there are no laws. The entire world's under a conquest. It's the right time to take over the state of West Virginia.
Has to be controlled. And at this point, it starts in West Virginia. West Virginia has been defaulted and dishonored. They were given secure hands for a transitional phase. But once again, the soil has to be controlled. And at this point, it starts in West Virginia.
He again confirms, soil has to be controlled. Head to Charleston to West Virginia.
And the guns as we do in private hands. There are other nations out there riding with hundreds of thousands of people with rocks and sticks, and they're taking to the streets en masse. And we have guns here, and we're not doing anything. And so they're looking at us. And they're actually laughing at us right now because we haven't done anything. So we've laid the lawful platform here in West Virginia to do it. The documents that's being drawn up will not be released until they're done and they're signed and that there is enforcement ready to go, because these documents are going to place the three men signing it in grave danger. And so we need to see people in West Virginia before they're released.
It's very good. It will be a select few
that can see the documents. Until we see bodies on the ground. So I would suggest that everybody start Google Earthing Charleston, because that is where most of these people are. You also have a National Guard armory on Coonskin Drive in Charleston. I would suggest you take a look at that too. Take a look at the Wood County State, or the West Virginia State Police, which is located in Charleston. And you have the Kanawha County Sheriff's in Charleston. Those are going to be the only ones close enough to do anything. And those of you with any military experience, I think you know how to counteract that. You have to remember that we are at war here. We have been declared enemies of our nation here. And if you haven't realized that war, let me tell you once again, we are at war. An overwhelming show of force will dictate that there will probably not be a shot fired. If there's just a moderate amount of people here, there may be shots fired.
Those in the military, they know how to counteract. Those in our National Guard, those in our law enforcement here in the state. And it starts to show how this could get bloody, where we might have to use force. In fact, we have to use force. And the people in the military, you know how to use force against our government to take it over. And one more clip that I want to go over.
Rioting and looting of the streets. I mean, well, how's this all going to be handled?
We're guilty of killing our enemy. And if you see the police coming and pulling up in a vehicle, I suggest you shoot them.
The police are our enemy. If you see them pulling up, shoot them. I don't think it could be more clear. We're taking over the West Virginia state government. The police are our enemy. Shoot them. And those in the military, you know how to handle the other people that are going to be there with guns. The judges read you off some elements to this crime, and I want to go over those elements and relate it to the evidence that you've heard. Go over these elements. First, we have to prove that it was the defendant, Thomas Deegan. We heard that through a couple witnesses. First, we heard through Trooper Williams, who could identify Thomas Deegan. We heard through Chief Steve Stevens, who could identify the defendant, Thomas Deegan. You, the jury yourselves, you heard Thomas Deegan
through this entire trial, you could probably identify his voice from listening to these conference calls as well. We heard from Trooper Williams, he can identify the call, his voice on these calls. And we heard today from that conference call offered by the defendant that voice that we heard on the conference call yesterday, that was the same voice that the defendant offered to you today that made all of these threats to the government. In Wood County, West Virginia, so the defendant Thomas Deegan in Wood County, West Virginia, it took place in Wood County, West Virginia. We heard from Chief Stevens that the defendant was on home confinement at the time. He was wearing a GPS bracelet. Chief Stevens could see exactly where the defendant was on September the 14th, 2015, when these threats were made, and he was at his house all day long in Mineral Wells, Wood County, West Virginia. On or about the blank day of September 2015, that's an element. How do we know that? First of all, we see September 14th, 2015 on the file of the conference call, if you recall. If you want to bring it up, you can look at that. We heard in the conference call itself that the takeover was to be 10 days later, on the 24th. And we also heard reference to the Pope's visit to the United Nations, which was to take place towards the end of September as well. We then hear from this conference call today that was offered by the defendant, that was a week after the conference call that we heard yesterday. Was the 21st, the week before that, September the 14th, 2015. And that the defendant did knowingly and willfully threaten to commit a terrorist act. We heard the terrorist acts. We listened to some of them there. We heard them all day yesterday. But what's a terrorist act? Well, a terrorist act is likely to result in serious bodily injury or damage to property or the environment. The police are our enemy. If you see the police, shoot them. That's obviously serious bodily injury. And they were going down to Charleston with an intent to do that. Those of you in the military, you know how to counteract those of the National Guard and the West Virginia State Police and Sheriff's Department. An intent and a possibility, actually a likelihood, that there will be serious bodily injury. And that terrorist act is intended to do one of four things. But I'll submit that not only does this do these threats meet one of these four things, they meet all four things. First, those threats were made to intimidate or coerce the civilian population, taking over your government, threatening to kill your police. You can't get much more intimidating. Influence the policy of a branch or level of government by intimidation or coercion. They're taking them out by force. These people in the Capitol, the governor, the legislators, they're taking them out by force. They're trying to influence the policy of a branch or level of government. They're taking it out completely. Affect the conduct of a branch or level of government by intimidation or coercion. The same idea. You're taking them out. You're affecting the conduct of that branch of, or level of government. Or retaliate against a branch or level of government for policy or conduct of the government. In the filings that you see here, the defendant filed with the Supreme Court, and the conference call that we heard, and the video that we saw yesterday, and the conference call that we heard today, he's not happy with the government. He doesn't think they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. And so what's he going to do? He's telling all these people from across the United States to come to Charleston and take them out. And this last one's key, too. That these threats, whether or not there was an intent to commit the terrorist act at the time these things were said, it's still a crime. So if he comes back later and says, oh, no, I don't want to do that, it doesn't matter. The state police, as you heard from Trooper Williams, the state police, the FBI, the Sheriff's Department, the Capitol Police, they all took that threat seriously. Those threats were made on September the 14th, 2015, and because of those threats, he had the state of West Virginia on high alert. It wasn't just Thomas Deegan. He was calling people, again, from all across the United States. So as I'm going through here, the state has obviously met all these elements of this crime. Because of the evidence that I've gone over with you and all the evidence that you've heard today and yesterday. And with this evidence, with the conference calls that you've heard, with the statements that you've made from the defendant, with the video that you saw, with the testimony that you heard, with this evidence, I'll ask today that you go back and find the defendant, Thomas Deegan, guilty of making terroristic threats.
Mr. Deegan?
All right. First off, we must remember that the prosecutor cannot, what he says is not testimony. A lot of it is grandstanding. And that the state must prove all of the elements that he showed us on the screen there beyond a reasonable doubt. According to the definition of threat, a communicated intent to inflict physical or other harm on any person or property. Communicated. That would mean that I communicated the governor. I talked to the governor, or I talked to the legislature, or I talked to someone and actually threatened them. I never talked to anyone. I never threatened anyone. They've failed to prove that I've threatened anything. They seem to be relying on a trooper who could not even sustain his complaint this morning under cross-examination. They lump you in with a bunch of rough ideas of because someone says something, you're in with this group. They brought up my complaint. I implore you to read the complaint because they keep pulling out a writ or mandamus that's asking for things, but they're not telling you why we're asking for that. We show you in the complaint why we're asking for that. Constitutional violations. All we asked for was a return to the constitutional rule of law. Not too much to ask for as people that live under the Constitution of this country. I don't have a problem with the Constitution. I have a problem when it's not obeyed. It's not obeyed. This is a government by, of, and for the people. And even our so-called rulers must follow the law. No one is above it. No one. Not even me. The original sworn complaint that started this entire matter, we went through this morning, and he was unable to come up with any facts other than it was just he had seen it in the past. It was part of this group that did it. He never had any firsthand evidence or facts. It was all conjecture and unsupported. Yes, I did phone calls going back through May of last year. They were educational. They were what you would call brainstorming sessions. People would come to me and say, look, we have this problem in our area. What have you found about it? Because what I do is research laws. I study laws that come directly from Congress, directly from the legislature. And we find out where things went wrong. Because when government's acting wrong, there's an act somewhere that they passed that was probably not constitutional that allows them to act that way. So we studied the law. We studied their case law. We found it. We presented it to them. There's nothing in there that is sovereign citizen in nature. As a matter of fact, my fellow friend today, Philip Hudock, a teacher for 40 years, signed on to this same complaint with me, a school teacher for 40 years, a retired postal worker, 72 years old, signed on to this complaint with me. Just because I'm 39 years old does not mean I'm a domestic terrorist. I love my country. I love my state. I love the kids of this country. And everything I've done since 07 has been to protect the children. Look on YouTube every day. You will see acts of violence committed by those in power against our children. And all we do is film it and post it. I took action and went to court. And then I went out and taught other people how to do it in other states. We do have the freedom of speech. Whether the government likes what we say or not, whether someone else likes what we say or not, it doesn't matter. We have the right to speak freely and clearly. And I fully intend to use every right that was given to me by God and constitutionally protected. And that's not a crime. It cannot be converted into a crime. That's the law. What is a threat? Okay? It's a communicated intent. They haven't proven that I've communicated any threat to anybody. What they prove is that I had people online with me that were from United States Special Forces Militia, a nationwide militia of people just like you, just like me. They're people of this country, citizens, that see something wrong and want to know what it is. And